how Erwin would sound like with a German accent. Today is your chance. And our first lecture today will be by Zhong Wang from the Perimeter Institute. He's going to give us a perspective on dualities from a condensed matter physics point of view. I'll give part two of that lecture myself tomorrow. That will then be more the particle physics view on dualities. And our TA today is Lujun Su. So if you asked any questions in the Q&A session, which is now the opportunity for the participants to ask questions during the talk, then Lujun will be in charge of answering those or referring some of them to the speaker if they're deemed important enough or interesting enough that we should get the input from Chong. So without any further ado, Chong, go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Andreas. So welcome. Everybody hearing me okay, right? I think. So I'll be talking about field theory dualities in from a condensed matter point of view today. And let me apologize beforehand that in all these slides, I didn't try to include all the references as complete as I can, simply because there are just too many of them. But I posted a review paper on the Slack channel. So if you go there, you can find one. And basically, all the relevant references are included there in case you want to read more. Okay. So basically, dualities roughly means very seemingly very different theories turn out to be secretly the same theory. Right? And that's usually appealing because typically we learn different things out of different theories. And when two theories turn out to be the same, we can combine everything we learned on different theories and form a more complete and insightful view. So my plan today is threefold. So I'll first, cover some basic notions using the classic particle vortex duality in 2+1 dimension as an example. So my goal here, partly is to explain some notions that are basic enough that a typical seminar speaker won't bother to explain, but not basic enough to be covered in a standard classroom. And then I'll go to a slightly more modern version of the duality, also sometimes known as a 3D bosonization. And then if I have time, I'll talk about the application to condensed matter problems such as Hopfield-Landau. So let me begin with the basic thing. So here's a historical motivation for this type of duality known as particle vortex duality or boson vortex duality. So the question really originally comes from classical statement. Right? So suppose I have a three-dimensional superconductor and I want to think about the finite temperature phase transition of it. Of course, you can do Landau theory and do mean field. If you actually measure in an experiment that will you basically get mean field result. But if you really consider fluctuation, right, the proper theory looks something like this. So you have a scalar field, which is basically your Cooper pair, the Cooper pair condensate, right? And this form looks like the standard Ginzburg-Landau theory. But the scalar is also coupled to the real world electromagnetic gauge field, right? So at finite temperature, it looks like a three-dimensional theory of a scalar coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field, right? And this plus dot 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 means in general I allow higher order terms. They are not necessarily small practically. So let me keep the form general. Right? So, and then I ask, what is the nature of the phase transition if I include all the fluctuations? Now, if I do a perturbative, let's say 4 minus epsilon dimensional expansion, then the conclusion, it was well known that I always end up with a first order transition. Okay. However, people later realized that if I put this theory on the lattice, it turns out I can map this theory to something that looks quite different. I can map this theory to the to this line, which is a complex scalar or a boson, but not coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field, so just a boson on its own. So to be a little bit more precise what I mean by this, so let me first say that strictly speaking, when I put it on a lattice, these two lines, they are actually lies. They don't look as simple as just this expansion. In particular, the dot, dot, dot term may be actually quite non-negligible. So on the lattice, typically it looks something like this. So I copied these three equations from the original Dasgupta-Hopgren paper. So the boson plus U1 gauge field theory side looks like this. So the partition function, in the partition function, take, for example, a three-dimensional cubic lattice. So on each vertex, on each side, there is a complex boson. So this theta phase is basically the phase angle of that boson field. And then on each link, there is a U1 gauge field defined. So you integrate them over. And then the action looks something like this. So this term is like the standard Maxwell term, curl A squared. And this term looks like an XY type of coupling. So it's a nearest neighbor coupling between the bosons, which is made gauge invariant. So this integer n is put in there to make the whole thing periodic in theta by 2 pi, right? So if you haven't seen this before, this term morally is very similar to something like cosine delta theta minus a. So that's the compact boson plus U1 gauge field theory defined on the lattice. So turns out if you take this partition function, you can do some smart change of variable, play some tricks, and convert it to this line, which is just a compact boson, no gauge field now. So these two partition functions, you can show that they are basically the same, up to some unimportant multiplicative overall factors. So what does that mean, right? So now let me recap. So this action, if you like, is really the shorthand notation of the previous more complicated looking lattice partition function. But now if you take this duality, then we know that on the complex boson side, there exists a continuous phase transition, which is the well-known O2-Wilson-Fisher phase transition, right? So then it means that in some parameter regime in this theory, there should also exist a continuous phase transition. Okay? And that's the power of duality manifested in this old classic example. And in fact, you can, it's also known that this O2-Wilson-Fisher universality class also describes a phase transition of a 2 plus 1 deep quantum superfluid insulator transition at zero temperature. For example, you take now a zero temperature, let's say optical lattice with cold atoms hopping on it, right? So there are two phases that you can imagine. One is called a mod insulator phase, where the particles is, let's say I have one particle sitting on each side, not moving. And for example, due to strong on-site repulsion between the particles. And then there's the other phase, which is just a superfluid where the particles just condense, right? So that phase transition is described also by this O2-Wilson-Fisher theory, right? So the statement is these two theories are dual to each other. So, okay, there is a lattice manipulation of partition function you can do, which you can just follow the algebra. There's nothing too weird about it, but you can ask a question deep down, why does such a transformation possibly work? What makes it possible for it? What makes it possible is that these two theories, even though they look very different, they have very similar structure. There are certain overall general structure that you can find on both sides. In particular, both sides actually has a global U1 symmetry. So on the scalar side, without gauge field, since I have a complex scalar, I can endow it with a U1 symmetry, which is basically the phase rotate, which is basically phi rotates by a phase. So this is a global symmetry I can think about. And that corresponds to a conserved current here. And on the gauge theory side, well, you can't talk about the U1 symmetry of the gauged particle, because that's a gauge symmetry, it's not a real symmetry. But whenever I have a U1 gauge field in 3 dimension or 2+1 dimension, turns out the gauge flux itself is a conserved current. Now, if I try to apply continuity equation on this object, it holds trivially. Okay, so basically the conserved boson charge on the ungauged side correspond to the conserved gauge flux on the gauge theory side. And that also means that these two theories, this ungauged boson, capital phi, and the gauged boson, little phi, sees each other as vortices, right? Because a phi charge looks like, on the gauge theory side, looks like a flux. In fact, with this normalization, it looks like a 2π flux, so which is just a 2π vortex. And that's what makes that gives this duality a name called particle vortex duality. And in fact, they are mutual vortices. Phi sees capital phi sees little phi as a vortex, and little phi sees capital phi also as a vortex. Okay. So local operators. Now, when you have a U1 U1 global symmetry, you can ask about local operators that's charged under this global U1. So here, in this talk, by local, it always automatically implies gauge invariance. So for example, on the gauge theory side, the little phi doesn't count as a local operator. Okay. So now on the ungauged boson theory, the operator that's charged under U1 is obviously just the scalar itself. Right? There's nothing weird about that. But now if you think about the gauged side, now the U1 charge is carried by the flux of the gauge field. So by definition, an operator charged under U1 should correspond to an operator that changes the gauge flux by 2π. So by definition, it's a flux insertion operator, which is also known as a monopole. Right? But unlike the usual monopole we dream about in real world, this monopole lives in 2+1 or 3 dimensions. Right? So if you like, if you think about this as your 2+1D space-time, then I have a point operator object defined in space-time that inserts a 2π flux. Yeah, think about this axis as time. So essentially, besides the symmetry and operator content, you can try to match a mean field phase diagram here, right? Suppose I write down, this Landau type of actions here. So here I've done one extra thing, which is since I now understand the global U1 symmetry, I can couple the system to a probe U1 gauge field. Let me call it capital A. So it's to be distinguished from this little a. So in this talk, whenever I have things like little a or little b, it always means a dynamical gauge field, meaning in the path integral, it's to be integrated over. While if I have capital A like this, it's a background gauge field. So you think of it as a probe. In the partition function, you fix it by hand. Okay. So now, of course, if I probe it, if I put in this gauge field on this capital phi side, it should just couple minimally. However, on the gauge theory side, it should couple like this, because remember the conserved current on the gauge theory side looks like the flux. So I should take this sometimes called BF or mutual Chen Simons type of coupling. Okay. Now with that, let me think about the mean field phase diagram here. So think about this M, this quadratic term. And suppose I work in the regime where the magnitude of M is much larger than any other scale, so that I can just safely do mean field calculation. Right? So with this choice of sign, if M is much smaller than zero, then on this side, obviously I should have a condensate of this phi. So the phi will have a non-trivial expectation value. So that's a superfluid. And if I go to very low energy and long distance, the only thing that remains is the sound mode or the ghost zone mode that comes from the spontaneous broken U1 global symmetry. And on the gauge theory side, now the claim is that this sign is inverted, right? So so if M is negative, and I do mean, and I think you know, perform a mean field calculation, then I'll conclude that this little phi is gapped. Right? So it's a massive particle. It can be integrated out safely. Nothing weird is going to happen. And then at, in the low energy, I get a free photon left over. And a free photon in 2+1 dimension or 3 dimension is basically indistinguishable from a free ordinary scalar, which is the Goldstone boson. Because right? Photon in 3 dimension, remember, has only one polarization, right? Unlike in 4 dimension. And then I can look at the opposite limit. If I have M very positive, then again, by mean field theory, this phi boson will just be, this capital phi boson will just be gapped. And then if I go to low energy and integrate out this capital phi boson, I get nothing in the IR, right? So it's, I have a trivial ground state or trivial insulator in the IR. And in this little phi theory, this little phi boson does the opposite thing, right? It with this choice of sign, it should condense. But once it condenses, the little a gauge field will also be Higgs'd, right? So again, at low energy and long distance, I get nothing left. So basically, that shows that the mean field phase diagram of these two theories also match, right? So intuitively, this is not that mysterious. Because as I said, this little phi, you should view it as the vortex of little, of capital phi, or vice versa. And then if I have a vortex insulator, that means I actually have a particle superfluid. Because in an ideal superfluid, the ground state has no vortex, basically. Right? On the other hand, if I have a vortex superfluid, meaning my vortex is fluctuating so badly, that destroys the phase coherence of the original superfluid, in which case I should get an insulator. So the physical intuition is actually quite clear. So what I said, everything I've said so far, strictly speaking, only applies to certain kind of lattice theories. And for those lattice theories, everything I said are basically correct because the mapping, the duality is essentially just a small change of variable in the partition function. So there's no approximation made anywhere, essentially. But now there's a slightly different statement that one is tempting to make. Remember, before, whenever I write down this Ginsburg-Landau-ish action, I always kept this dot dot dot. There, strictly speaking, they could be quite important, because they come from the lattice. But then there is a version of the statement that gets rid of the dot dot dot. You can ask, can I, get rid of the dot 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 and still hope this duality to work? That would be a much cleaner or simpler statement. And for this theories, at least that's a sensible statement to try to make. For example, I now take this theories and I try to take the continuum limit by sending formally the momentum cutoff to infinity. So that's doable because both theories are actually super renormalizable. When you do that, you don't encounter anything illegal, right? And in this way, you basically get rid of all the dot 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 if you take this limit. On the lattice, that actually corresponds to some weak coupling limit. So the theory has to be weakly coupled on the lattice to get you a theory like this in the continuum limit, strictly speaking. Okay. So which means the lattice duality does not actually imply a continuum theory duality of this sort. Because the two lattice theories, I defined earlier, you can look at how the coupling constant works, and you'll conclude there that there's no way to make both theories weakly coupled at the lattice scale. Right? So strictly speaking, the lattice duality does not imply a continuum field theory duality like this. But still, we know that very often, well, not always, but often, a lattice theory at strong coupling has the same IR fate as a weakly coupled lattice theory, in the sense that they all, under renormalization group flow, they eventually flow to the same fixed point. Okay. So if that is true in our case, then the lattice duality will imply that these two renormalizable continuum field theories are actually also dual to each other, but in the sense that they flow to the same IR fixed point. Okay. So for that reason, we call the lattice theory duality, sometimes we call this kind of duality weak dualities, and we call the continuum field theory dualities strong dualities. Well, we call this lattice theory duality weak partly because they are just easier to establish. Right? You just take some lattice theory, try to find a smart change of variable, you're basically done. But justifying continuum field theory dualities like this tend to be much harder. So let me explain a little bit more what I mean by this continuum field theory dualities. The statement is a little bit different from the lattice duality I made earlier, because the lattice duality I made, I talked about earlier, they hold on any scale, because they hold on lattice scale, and then under renormalization group flow, of course, they should also hold. So, however, for this renormalizable continuum field theory dualities, by definition, in the UV, these theories are free. Right? So if I work at a momentum scale that's, for example, much larger than all my scale, like the quadratic coupling lambda and the Maxwell coupling constant E squared, the fine structure constant, which in three dimension, both have the dimension of the energy or momentum. Okay? So if I work at this large momentum scale, they're all free theories. This one is a free scalar, this one is a free scalar plus a free photon. And it's easy to check that these two theories can't possibly be the same. You just perform some free field calculation. For example, you can see that scaling dimensions couldn't possibly match. Okay? But the statement is now, if I follow the renormalization group flow and move my momentum scale from UV on this side, for example, if I move from UV to a scale that's much below this quadratic coupling lambda, then I'm expected to land on this O2 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So this renormalization group flow is pretty well established. You can, well established in the sense that you can do epsilon expansion, you get pretty good result compared to either experiment or numerics. So on this side, though, you start from a free scalar plus free photon, and then you flow down to a scale below lambda, you expect to get a Wilson-Fisher scalar plus a free photon, assuming that this E square, the Maxwell coupling strength, is below the quadratic coupling lambda, which means you flow to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point first, and then you introduce the U1 gauge coupling. Okay. And then if this continuum duality holds, then the statement is if you further flow down to a scale much below E square, you should also land on this O2 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay? So that's if you really think about it, it's actually an extremely non-trivial statement. Right? Nobody knows how to justify this using any analytic calculation. In fact, the reason we believe that this is true is mainly through numerical verification. By the way, as a side comment, things like the ordering of lambda and E square in this theory, for example, which one is larger, which one is smaller, that actually does matter. So this whole thing could work only if lambda is reasonably bigger than E square. So in the language of a superconductor, that means this superconductor is type 2. Otherwise, you get a first order transition. And it's actually that's actually quite natural from a super, if you know something about superconductors, because for type 2 superconductors, the vortices repel each other. And for type 1, the vortices attract each other. But if the particles attract each other, they tend to have this first order type of transition. Okay. So let me comment a little bit more about weak versus strong duality. Because people coming from different backgrounds tend to focus more on either one of this. For example, typically our friends from the high energy field theory community care more about this strong dualities because for them, most of the time they live in the continuum anyway. Right? But this also tend to be harder to justify. And for condensed matter problem, very often we actually only care about the weak dualities. Because we always have, to some extent, everything comes from the lattice anyway. Right? So the weak duality, typically, you only have to justify it for some lattice theories, which is much easier. And usually to check whether you have such a duality, you can just perform some simple, quote-unquote, kinematic check, meaning you just look at the mean field phase diagram and look at whether you have the same set of symmetries and a set of local operators on both theories, which I just showed you roughly how to do for the case of particle vortex duality. But if I want a strong duality to hold, I need to look at things, dynamical aspects, like exactly how the RG flow works, and whether the critical exponent match and so on. Right? So that takes more work. And for that reason, very often those continuum field theory dualities are conjectures, and sometimes if you are lucky, you can verify them numerically. But one thing that's worth emphasizing is that depending on your purpose, you may or may not need to use the strong duality. Very often, especially for condensed matter problems, the weak dualities are good enough for our purpose. Right. So you need the strong duality, things like the continuum field theory duality. If you care, for example, about critical properties of a gapless theory, right? And for example, in the application to the, what's known as the deconfined quantum criticality, you need this continuum field theory dualities. However, if your goal is to explore interesting phases of matter, for example, various funny topological orders, or you want to essentially, make a guess, right? You want to guess that that some interesting phases exist for some Hamiltonian. Then turns out the weak duality is good enough for you. Okay. So let me talk about hopefully an even more familiar duality that more illustrate the similar idea, maybe in a simpler setting. So if I look at the 1 plus 1D transverse field Ising model, or if you prefer 2D classical Ising model, there is the well-known duality called Kramers-Fournier duality, sometimes also called the high temperature, low temperature duality. So if I write down a lattice Hamiltonian, if I have a 1D chain of Ising spins, for example, I can write down this transverse field Ising model. And it's also well known that if I make a non-trivial change of variable in this fashion, right, then I can convert it to another Ising model, except this transverse field H and the Ising coupling are exchanged. For that reason, it's sometimes called a self-duality. And the meaning, if you look at these equations, especially if you look at this equation, then the meaning of this dual Ising variable tau z is clear. That it basically creates a domain wall in the original ferromagnet, because this object flips all the spins on its left, for example. So if you like, you can think of it as the 1D version of a vortex, because it's a defect in the order parameter. However, let me emphasize one subtlety, which is it's a little bit misleading to say this is just a self-duality, because this tau and the sigma they don't really have the same status, right? So if I work in a theory where sigma is my original degree of freedom, which means sigma is a local operator defined in my Hilbert space, then tau z cannot be a local operator. One thing you can realize is that if I put it on the ring, right, and I look at this expression, then immediately I see that there's no way I can just fix the boundary condition of tau z by hand. For example, if I put it on the ring, then tau z at I equal to L is not going to be tau z at I equal to 1. They're going to differ by this object, which is the total Ising spin. Right? That means that whether tau z obeys periodic or anti-periodic boundary condition depends on the total Ising charge. This is a pretty well-known statement. There's nothing new here. What I'm emphasizing is that whenever you have something like this, you should really view tau z not as a local object, but as an operator that's coupled to a dynamical Z2 gauge field. Right. So a Z2 gauge field in 1+1 dimension, in case you're not familiar with it, is actually quite simple. It basically decides whether your boundary condition is periodic or anti-periodic in a direction when you have closed loop. So the correct statement of this duality is really that the Ising scalar is dual to another Ising scalar but coupled to a dynamical Z2 gauge field. So there is a continuum version of that statement which you can make. Don't worry if some of the symbols don't look familiar. Mostly I won't need them. So on this side, I have the 5-4 Ising theory, right, which is represented by a real scalar. And on this side, if you neglect things like little b, capital B, which I will come back later, you have another 5-4 real scalar theory with an inverted MOS. Right? That's this MOS inversion just come from exchanging this J and H on the lattice scale. Let me explain the notation. So this capital B or little b represent just Z2 gauge field. Right? And you should really think of this just as a symbol. Right? It doesn't look quite similar as the usual minimum coupling of a continuous gauge field. Right? So as I said, what the gauge field does is just to set the boundary condition of this phi or phi tilde scalars. When I say this capital B is a background gauge field, it means I get to fix the boundary condition of phi by hand. I get to decide whether they are periodic or anti-periodic. That's part of my definition. However, when this little b is dynamical, it means that in the partition function, I should actually sum over both sectors, sum over all sectors in principle. Okay. And again, that's a well-known statement in the CFT language. I'm just rephrasing it in a gauge theory language. That makes a certain comparison more transparent. And also there is this funny term. Don't worry if you don't know, if the symbols don't look familiar. Basically you think of it as a term that assigns, the function of this term is basically whenever you have an anti-periodic boundary condition in little b, in phi tilde, which means a non-trivial flux of little b, then there is a non-trivial global Z2 charge associated with this capital B. So that statement looks very similar to the little a d capital A, the BF term in the particle vortex duality. Remember there, what this term does is to assign a global U1 charge probed by capital A to a magnetic flux of little a. Right? Here, this term is basically doing the same, except u1 is replaced by z2, and three dimension is replaced by two dimension. Okay, so you can even ask about, you know, in a very similar spirit, operators that's charged under the global z2. So on the Ising scalar side, that's obviously just this phi scalar, the real scalar. But on this side, right, it's actually an operator that changes the flux of little b, right? So it's a flux insertion operator. Well, in the CFT language, it's better known as the twist field. Right? So again, I'm not saying anything really new here, just rephrasing it. But putting it this way makes the similarity to the particle vortex duality more apparent, right? Because remember, in the particle vortex duality, the original complex scalar is dual to a flux insertion or monopole operator in the U1 gauge theory. So here, the story is basically the same. Well, very similar. So couple comments. First comment is, for all the reasons I explained, this is not really a self-duality. It appears to be one, because Z2 gauge field tend to be pretty boring dynamically. Dynamically meaning, for example, it doesn't change things like your scaling dimension. In fact, it doesn't even change the critical coupling, right? That's why you can determine the exact critical coupling strength, which is J equal to H in the original Ising model using this duality. But topologically, it could be very interesting for reasons I just explained. And another comment is that logically, this continuum field theory duality does not directly follow from the lattice duality. For this duality to follow from the lattice duality, you need to make one extra assumption, which is the lattice theory at critical coupling has the same IR fate as this phi-4 scalar field theory. Of course, practically nobody doubts that statement, because we have so many highly non-trivial evidences for that. Right? For example, you can take this theory, do a 4 minus epsilon calculation, push to epsilon equal to 2, the exponent you get are basically the same as the exact solutions on the lattice. So nobody doubts that. But you know, if you go to more and more complicated lattice systems, then this assumption becomes more and more non-trivial. In fact, if you, start doing parton theories on lattice models, which you'll probably see in the next couple of days, that's always a serious assumption in your logic. Okay, so that's how much I want to say about basic stuff and the particle vortex duality. So before I enter into things that are slightly more modern, let me pause here and see if there are questions.
We have some questions from the Q&A session. Maybe there are two unanswered questions left. Should we take those?
Okay. What are these? Let me read with... Oh, okay. One question from Matthew. With open BC, is the Cramer's one-year duality truly a self-duality? Okay, good. So with open boundary condition, if I have an open chain, the Z2 gauge field is still there. The only thing is it looks even more boring than the Z2 gauge field on the ring. But there is still a, for example, on the dual side, there is still a non-local object I can think of, which is essentially the Wilson line of the Z2 gauge field across the entire line. But on the two ends, I couple it to two charged Z2 charged objects. So that's a gauge invariant line object. So in that sense, it's not strictly a self-duality. But again, that object tend to be less interesting than when it's on the ring. So another comment is it's things like this that makes, for example, the ground state degeneracy works, right? Because if the Ising symmetry is spontaneously broken, you're supposed to have twofold ground state degeneracy. And you're supposed to reproduce that on the dual side. And so if it's strictly a self-duality, that can't possibly work. Yeah, so that maybe that's a simpler way to answer that question.
Justin, okay. Also raise their hands while we're doing this quick Q&A session too. I can see whether people raise hands and I can pick you, but we have like, if you like to answer any one of these new questions on the Q&A.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe let me just move on. So,
we'll have more opportunities.
I've already been doing more slowly than I expected. So now let me move on to things that are slightly more modern. So everything I've talked so far, they come from the 70s, 80s. But this one comes from a more recent time. So here's another statement of the duality, which I'll explain in the next few minutes. This duality involves two theories. One theory is actually, again, in two plus one dimension. So this theory, So this theory actually looks much simpler than the Wilson-Fisher boson. Right? Wilson-Fisher boson, it's an intrinsically strongly interacting theory. So, but this one is just free Dirac fermion. Right? Everything, we know everything about it. And the statement is that it's actually dual to a theory that looks sort of bosonic. So on this side, I have a Wilson-Fisher boson, phi. That's again coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field. Now, this time, let me call it little b, right? But it's just a U1 gauge field with a Maxwell term and quantic coupling, also with this mutual BF coupling to the external U1 gauge field. So all this looks pretty much the same as the particle vortex duality before, except I have this extra Trans-Siemens term, BdB. So that turns out to change everything. But before moving on, let me explain a little bit what I mean by this side, because people from different communities tend to use slightly different notations for essentially what it means to have a two-component gapless Dirac fermion in two plus one dimension. Okay. So let me clarify that. When I write down the left-hand side, what I really mean, if I regularize everything properly, is that if I integrate out the Dirac fermions, I get this partition function. Right? So there is a magnitude part, which is just a fermion determinant, the magnitude of the fermion determinant. That's not too interesting for our purpose. And then there is a phase factor. So this phase factor involves this object known as the eta invariance. So practically what it does is to give you a whole conductance of minus one half of the conductance quantum. So which is expected even from a lattice point of view. Right? If I try to realize a single gapless Dirac fermion on a lattice system, I always end up getting a whole conductivity, which is a half odd integer. Okay. So minus one half is just one choice. If you like, you can think of it as whenever you realize a Dirac fermion on the lattice, there is always another Dirac fermion, possibly gapped, right? Possibly with a large gap. But that gapped Dirac fermion will contribute an extra whole conductance to your system. So in terms of Hall conductance, this eta invariance looks very much similar to just the Trans-Siemens term. If you take this Trans-Siemens term and vary with respect to the gauge field, for example, you get the same Hall conductivity. However, the difference is that this eta invariance is manifestly gauge invariant, while the Trans-Siemens term with this coefficient is known as level one half or level minus one half is not invariant under a large gauge transform. So sometimes this whole thing, or this whole object, we defined is just denoted as the a Dirac term. But properly regularized, this PV represent polyvilar. For example, if you use a polyvilar regulator with a positive mass, then you will end up with this partition function. Okay? So this is a, if you like, a gauge invariant definition of a two-dimensional, a two plus one-dimensional Dirac fermion, but that definition breaks time reversal because it comes with the Hall conductance. And this is just a well-known statement of parity anomaly. So in our notation, this Dirac fermion, Dirac term, will be different from this polyvilar regularized Dirac term. So if I take the partition function, by definition, it's going to be this one subtracted by this transimons term. So the partition function will basically be this object. So eta invariance of the original one, then compensated by this half-level transimon term. And then there is a theorem called the APS index theorem that guarantees that this overall phase factor is actually real. It can at most be a sign. So this I is actually the index of the Dirac operator in one dimension higher with the boundary condition appropriately chosen. So essentially what I'm saying is we are defining this Dirac Dirac term in a way such that it is time reversal invariant, but not fully gauge invariant.
Can I quickly interrupt you just to clarify? There have been some questions in the chat about the definition of ADA. Maybe that would be important to clarify since it seems to play an important role in what you're talking about.
Yeah, so ADA is basically, I didn't want to go into detail of the definition of ADA. I mean, it's basically some index that you can define out of the Dirac operator. The only thing important I want to say is that it gives you Hall conductance and its gauge invariant, right? Which, for example, you can think of it as coming from this lattice system, right? So whenever you have a lattice system, by definition, you'll end up with a gauge invariant partition function, right? Because you can gauge it on a lattice. There's no problem with that. And we also know that this lattice system will give you Hall conductance 1/2, right? You can just do a band theory calculation and conclude that. Now you try to put these two things together, then you know that you definitely need a factor like this, right? Which gives you the correct Hall conductance, but has to be gauge invariant, which means it can't just be the transimons term. Yeah, I mean, there is a more mathematical definition in terms of the indices, the index of this 2+1 dimensional Dirac operators. But let me not go into that. Let me just say that if you want to know more detail about that, this review paper by Wooten is a good source. But in the following, I won't actually use any serious property of this ETA invariance. Okay, so now let me, with those clarification, let me now actually state this duality. Right? So Dirac fermion dual to Wilson-Fisher boson coupled to a U1 gauge field with transimon level one. So by the way, in case you wonder about notation, I've secretly switched to Lorentz signature just so that I don't have to keep writing factors of I here. That's why you see a minus sign here. And I've also been lazy that I dropped the terms like Maxwell term, and I put the quadratic term coupling to one to be one. Not because those things are not important, but this is just a shorthand notation. So to some extent, everything I write is a shorthand notation of what's actually correct. But with that understanding, now let's look at these two theories. Again, we can play similar games as what we did for the particle vortex duality. There, for both theories, there is an obvious U1 symmetry. I mean, for the Dirac fermion, that's the U1 phase rotation. And on the gauge theory side, it's just the magnetic flux of the dynamical gauge field, little b. What's more interesting is the operator that's charged under the U1 symmetry. On the Dirac side, it's just the Dirac fermion. On the gauge theory side, well, naively you say it's again a flux insertion operator, since the U1 charge is represented by flux. But that's not enough, because there is this Chern-Simons term that requires attaching, you know, by gauge invariance, because a naive flux will not be gauge invariant because of the Chern-Simons term. So by gauge invariance, you need to attach to the flux insertion operator or a monopole operator a scalar phi. And it turns out this Chern-Simons term, when you do this flux attachment, it also converts the whole thing to a fermion. Okay. And this is actually a relativistic version of what's known as flux attachment. So in the traditional flux attachment in the quantum Hall context, you view a fermion as a combination of a boson and its vortex. It's doing exactly that here. So think of this fermion object here as this combination of boson and its vortex. In fact, this spin direction will play a role later in an interesting way. So again, we can check the mean field phase diagram, see if it works. It's basically designed so that it works. So let's perturb everything by a mass term. Strictly speaking, I should assume that the mass is much larger than any other scale on the interacting side. But let me not be that careful here. We understand the subtlety. Okay. So on the Dirac theory side, the effect of the mass term is pretty simple, right? Essentially, whenever M is non-zero, the Dirac fermion is gapped and you can integrate out. The only thing non-trivial left is a response term. That's a Chern-Simons term at level plus minus 1/2. Okay? And the sign is determined by the sign of the mass. So with this background Chern-Simons term there, you realize that for M negative, you get a Chern-Simons response of minus 1, and for M positive, you get nothing, right? So which means this is really a transition between a trivial insulator and an integer quantum Hall state, or a chain insulator, if you like. So this is really a version of a simple version of the quantum Hall transition. Now on the scalar side, well, there are two scenarios, right? So if M is positive, then it turns out this phi will condense with our choice of sign. Right? And when phi condenses, the little b gauge field is Higgs, and then the Chern-Simons term doesn't really play a role anymore. So what you get is a trivial Higgs phase, which is basically a trivial insulator. But if you have the opposite sign of mass, which is negative, and then you have this little phi gap, and what you are left with in the IR is just a pure Chern-Simons gauge theory that looks like this. And this little b is a dynamical. So now this little b is purely Gaussian. So you know, there's nothing to stop you from integrating out. And you know, this, for this Gaussian theory, integrating out is basically a fancy way to say you solve the classical equation of motion and plug it back in. So if you do that, you realize that you get a response term that's minus level 1 Chern-Simons for the capital A. Okay. So basically, on the bosonic, on a scalar side, you also get to reproduce the mean field phase diagram of a phase transition from the integer quantum Hall insulator to a trivial insulator. And in fact, this has been reasonably well known in the quantum Hall community. So that's how you construct integer quantum Hall state out of composite bosons, essentially. So let me say a little bit about status of this duality. So as I said, there are two slightly different notions of duality in our context. So as a weak duality, this duality is fully established. Nobody really questions it for many, many reasons. Right? So there are general arguments like the kinematic checks I just showed you couple minutes ago. You can do other things. You can construct lattice models, very similar to the Dasgupta-Hoprin Peskin lattice duality. You can do something that looks lattice-ish. So this is known as couple wire construction, meaning the continuum limit is taken in one direction, so you get it, but the other direction remains discrete. So you get essentially a bunch of wires of Luttinger liquid or 1D CFT, one plus 1D CFT. And there, you know, you can show that there's some couple wire realization of both theories that are, that agree on the lattice scale. But again, problem is they all add strong coupling. So they don't directly tell you whether your continuum field theory is true, field theories are due. And then this theory is also related to supersymmetric mirror dualities. You take some mirror dualities and break supersymmetry, you will also land on this duality. However, as a strong duality, this, strictly speaking, remains a conjecture. And you know, we're still waiting if anyone can do it numerically, which is challenging because this theory suffers from sign problems. If you try to simulate it with Monte Carlo, it's not a trivial, it's not an easy task. Of course, you can ask, you know, if this strong duality is not true, what could be the possible competing scenario? Well, the competing scenario is always that the bosonic side, the scalar coupled to a U1 Chen Simons theory at level one actually flows to a first order transition. So that's a scenario that's very hard to rule out. It's also a very boring scenario. Of course, there are other more exotic scenarios there. For example, maybe, you know, a priori, we cannot rule out the possibility that that scalar theory flows to yet another distinct fixed point. But again, but actually, those type of scenarios sounds way too interesting to be possibly true. So the main competing scenario is this one. So let me also comment about time reversal symmetry a little bit. So as I said, if I try to get rid of that that Chen Simon term at level 1/2, right, now I consider just the Dirac term, which is not completely gauge invariant, but it's time reversal invariant. For example, this is what I would get on the surface of a topological insulator. Okay. So now I take this field theory, but I move this level 1/2 Chen Simon theory to this side, so I get this theory. So one puzzling feature of this duality is that the left-hand side is manifestly time reversal invariant, but the right-hand side is a little bit weird. So if I naively apply time reversal on this side, right? So this Wilson-Fisher boson looks perfectly fine with time reversal, but those Chen Simon terms tend to inverse signs under time reversal transformation, right? And I've taken my power of renaming symbols to just call the phi's phi tilde and b's b tilde after time reversal transform. It's just a rename, which will be convenient later. Right? So naively, these two theories don't look the same, which then you can question whether this theory could possibly be time reversal invariant. If not, then this duality, you run into trouble with this duality statement. It can't really be true. Well, it turns out, even though this theory after time reversal transform is not completely identical to the original one, but it's actually dual to it. And it's dual in a quite simple way, actually. The only thing you need to do is to perform a boson vortex duality on this scalar phi tilde. Right? So I think this is the only place where I actually want to do a little bit of algebra for you, because it's just pretty neat. So essentially, if I take this piece of that, the action, which is basically a Wilson-Fisher boson, so I can apply the boson vortex duality and convert that to another Wilson-Fisher boson, now I call phi. But then there is this mutual BF coupling, or mutual Chern-Simons coupling, between the original B tilde and a new gauge field that I now define as B. Okay, so these two are dual to each other. And now I just copy the rest of the term, this Chern-Simons term. But look at one particular feature. That is this B tilde gauge field now only couples to other gauge field through Chern-Simons coupling. It no longer couples to any matter field. So again, it becomes a purely quadratic theory. And there's no difficulty with integrating it out. Now you just integrate out little b, right? Again, just solve the classical equation of motion and put it back in. What you find is that this theory becomes 1 over 4 pi b plus a dB plus a. Okay, and now it's just a very simple algebra to realize that if I combine this term and this term, I get exactly this term. Right, that should be doable in real time. And also I get a Wilson-Fisher boson here and a Wilson-Fisher boson here. Even the symbols are the same by design. So in this way, just by doing a particle vortex duality on this scalar phi tilde, I recover time reversal symmetry. Right? So the message is time reversal acts in a rather non-trivial way on this scalar. So it brings this scalar to its vortex, which is, if this scalar is a local boson, that sounds problematic, because vortex is non-local object, and it can't bring a local boson to a non-local object through a symmetry transform. But in this case, little phi is coupled to a little b gauge field, so it's non-local, it's not gauge invariant to begin with, so there's no problem with doing that. Sorry. Yeah. So pictorically, it can be you can view it this way. So I have a Dirac fermion, which comes with a Dirac spin. And under time reversal, the Dirac spin is supposed to flip. Now there is a very simple interpretation of that in the boson in the scalar language. Now I view this Dirac fermion as a combination of this scalar boson phi and its vortex. And the spin direction is roughly this direction of this vortex boson dipole, if you like. And under time reversal, the boson is supposed to become a vortex, and the vortex is supposed to become the boson, which means the Dirac spin direction also gets reverted, which is what you require for a Dirac fermion in 2+1 dimension. So everything fits quite nicely here. So maybe all those look a little bit unfamiliar, but I claim that there is a much more familiar setting where, you know, many of you have probably seen something like this. That is the Jordan-Wigner duality in 1+1 dimension. So let me go again back to the 1+1D transverse field Ising model. Of course, it's well known that beside this type of rewriting, there is yet another way to rewrite the Ising model as a chain of non-interacting Majorana fermions. Okay. What you need is essentially just to multiply the sigma and tau together. Remember, sigma is the original spin, and tau is an operator that creates a domain wall. Okay. So if you define the operator this way, then this ETS will be Majorana fermions. And this way of writing makes it obvious that this is actually a version of flux attachment. Right? Sigma is your original particle, and sigma is the Ising spin, and tau is its domain wall. Okay. And also, when you write it as a fermion theory, you can impose a symmetry. Let me call it S.
Is this your 10-minute warning? Okay.
Okay. I should be. Okay. Good. So you can impose a symmetry that takes eta r to eta r plus one. And you know, if you impose this symmetry, you can see that you'll force J to be equal to H, and the system will be enforced to be at the gapless point. Okay. This symmetry is also sometimes known as the chiral symmetry if you take the continuum limit, because in the continuum limit, this theory looks like a gapless Majorana fermion, and this symmetry is nothing but the chiral symmetry of the Majorana fermion. So what does this look like in this sigma or tau picture, right, in the spin picture? Well, if you literally just plug in this symmetry transform to this relation, then what you realize is that this what this symmetry does is to exchange sigma with tau, tau to sigma. So what it does is to exchange spin and domain one. So this is very similar to what time reversal does in the 3D bosonization I just talked about. So there, time reversal exchanges the a boson and its vortex. Right? Here it's essentially the Z2 version of that. Okay. Let me skip this. And so let me comment that you can think about emergent symmetries from duality more generally. Right? So I told you two examples, the 3D bosonization and the Jordan-Wigner, where the symmetry on one side of the theory is more easily manifest than the theory on the other side. So more generally, you can think about two theories that are dual in the IR, but in general, they can, you know, they are different in the UV, which means the symmetry of the two theories could be different in the UV, right? But if they flow to the same IR fixed point, then in general, my IR fixed point, and if I assume that none of the symmetries is spontaneously broken during the RG flow, then the IR physics should contain an enlarged or emergent symmetry group that contains at least the symmetries of the UV theories on both sides. So this is actually a powerful way to understand emergent symmetries in interacting quantum field theories, assuming these dualities. And this emergent symmetries, in the examples I showed you, they are discrete, they're time reversal or some Z2 chiral symmetry. But there are also examples where the symmetries are continuous. So you can have emergent continuous symmetries understood this way. And that approach has been quite fruitful in the study of what's called the deconfined quantum critical point, which I won't go into. So yeah, I don't think I should realistically do the Hopfield lambda level. So let me just say one more thing. Actually, starting from this 3D bosonization duality, you can derive, quote unquote derive, or I would more prefer to say you can motivate many of the other dualities, in fact, infinitely many other dualities, by following what's called the SNT or SL2Z operation. Essentially, you take two theories that are dual to each other. Suppose they have a U1 symmetry, so you can couple them to U1 gauge field, capital A. And there are two operations which you can perform on both sides. Since the two sides are basically the same anyway, as long as you are performing the same operation, you should land on also another duality. Right? So the first operation is quite simple. It's just adding some background Hall conductivity, if you like, or a Chen Simons term, but with the integer coefficients so that everything is properly quantized. The other operation, which is more non-trivial, is called operation S, which is basically to promote the probe gauge field to a dynamical U1 gauge field, or if you like, to gauge the global U1 symmetry. Right? But once you gauge a global U1 symmetry, there is another conserved flux coming out of the gauge field. So you can further add this mutual BF coupling. I'm sorry, this side should be little a. Right. So you can do that on both sides and it will give you another duality. And it turns out this S operation and T operation, they form an SL2Z group, which means that you can generate essentially infinitely many dualities this way. And one of the dualities generated this way looks like this. So it's again, a free Dirac fermion, but dual to a Dirac fermion coupled to a U1 gauge field. In this case, no Chen Simons term is needed. But there's some caveat to that statement, but let me not go into that. So this just looks like very similar to the particle vortex duality. Remember, the boson vortex duality is a Wilson-Fisher boson that's dual to a Wilson-Fisher boson coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field. This is essentially the Dirac fermion version of that. You can perform all kinds of kinematic checks on this duality. You can look at the symmetries. You can look at the set of local, meaning gauge invariant operators, and look at the phase diagram upon MOS deformation, and they all agree. Let me not go into the Hafio-Landau level story, because that requires definitely more than 5 minutes to do any to cover anything seriously. So let me just skip to the last thing, which is there are many things that I didn't have time to talk about, obviously. So I didn't have time to talk about the application of that fermion-fermion duality to the Hafio-Landau level problem, which is known as Song's theory. That's first worked out by Dan Song. That's one of the most successful applications of this duality story to condensed matter physics. But there are many other applications of this kind of duality to condensed matter problems, such as deconfined quantum criticality, various topological orders and their phase transitions, quantum Hall plateau transitions, superconductor insulator transitions, or more recently even quantum phase transitions in Kitai materials. And also the dualities I just told you, this 2+1D dualities, they have a rather close relationship to another, in some sense more familiar dualities in 3+1 dimension. These are the electric magnetic dualities of 3+1D U1 gauge theory. And for condensed matter people, maybe a familiar term is the U1 quantum spin liquids. So with that, let me, so here's a summary. So, one thing I just want to emphasize before I end is that the duality can be appealing since a problem that's hard in one theory may become a bit simpler in the other. So let me summarize that there are roughly three scenarios where that simplification can happen. So the first scenario is when this theory is just solvable. So that's what happens in, for example, Jordan-Wigner. You map Ising model to more or less a free Majorana fermion problem, even though that Majorana fermion is coupled to a Z2 gauge field. But again, Z2 gauge field doesn't really change anything dynamically. So you can still solve everything. And there are examples where certain properties like symmetries are more manifest in the other theory. That way you can figure out some non-trivial property of theory one as well. And there are a third aspect, which is relevant to actually many condensed matter applications, including the Hafio-Landau level application, which is maybe you can't really solve any of this theory, but somehow you can, in one theory than the other, it's easier to just make a guess. You can just get some crazy wild mean field solution and start to try to include fluctuations, pretending they are small and so on. That kind of thing is just easier to do probably in one of the dual theories. So with that, let me just end here and take questions.
If you have about 30 seconds for maybe one quick question, people can raise hands. Otherwise, there's one question in the Q&A.
Okay, I saw questioning.
Yeah, let's go. There's a question from Pierre Fromholz. Is there a recipe to establish the exhaustive web of dualities of a given model?
So a recipe to establish the. I'm not sure what a given. Oh, I see. I see. You mean from starting from one theory? Is there a way to exhaust all possible theories that's due to it? I'm not aware of it. I mean, it's extremely hard to say. Look, I have a set of duality, and there can't be anything more. I don't think that's easy to establish.
I think given that we're out of time, we probably should stop. There's opportunity for more questions in the afternoon. Sean will be available to answer all your questions in all gory detail. But maybe now we should take a break. I can applaud. You can quietly applaud in the audience. Thank you, Sean. And we go into break. And that we continue at 12:40, right, with the next talk by Pablo on real world phenomena and like more materials. Right, thanks, John.
Thanks, Andrea.